Hi, I'm Susie Burrell.
And I'm Leanne Ward.
And welcome to The Nutrition Couch, a weekly podcast from two of Australia's leading dietitians, bringing you everything that is new in the world of nutrition, diets, and good food. From The Nutrition Couch today, period nutrition. What to eat at that time of the month to help manage cramping and the terrible cravings that can see us demolish an entire block of chocolate without even noticing. There is a growing amount of research in this area and we are going to give you the latest. Our clinic case study is all about treats. We all love having them, but how many is too many? Not only for us, but also for our kids. Our product review is on one of our favourite yogurts, and our listener question of the week is an oldie, but a very popular question. Is it butter or margarine? But to kick us off this week, I am really excited to share that Leanne is coming to Sydney. And it may come as a bit of a surprise to our listeners, but even though we have known each other through work for quite some time, we actually don't know each other that well, and we've only really been in a room together twice in our entire lives. So the fact that you're coming to Sydney for quite a few days and we've got some time to really hang out and I can take you to some of the local cafes and we can do some work on our podcast, I am really, really excited. But yeah, we actually don't know each other that well.
No, we don't, which is why it's very exciting. It's a good work trip for us. And yeah, I'm going to head out to the Blue Mountains for a couple of days and do a little bit of hiking around there. I think I may regret that decision. I'm not a winter person, Susie. I'm very much a Queensland sunny girl through and through, summer lover. And I looked at the weather in the Blue Mountains this morning and I think it was like -2 degrees overnight or something. And I was like, oh, what have I done?
Well, when you said you were going to the Blue Mountains, I was just thinking about this last night because it's like really crisp. Like, you are going to know you are alive because Sydney is crisp, but not, you know, overly cold. We're pretty lucky. We're lucky to have a light jacket through winter. But the Blue Mountains is another level. Like, you, I would suggest you get some thermals because mm-hmm. you're not going to, like, you're pretty lean already. Like, it is really, really cold there.
I've got some thermals. Yep. I've got a big duck jacket, like a big puffer jacket, like a 3/4 one. It goes right down to my knees, I think. I actually went to Florida on a business course. Must have been 2 years ago now. And it was -3 when I landed. And that puffer jacket served me well. So I'm going to bring that with me to the Blue Mountains, hopefully. And yeah, hopefully I'll be okay. I'll do double socks and some thermals underneath.
Yes. And there'll be a lot of hot chocolates being drunk, I think. So 100%. But I'll leave that with you and you'll be rushing back to Sydney because you'll be like, that was nice, but never again.
Exactly. We're just going for one night. So we're just one night, do the big hike there. Might even, I think there's some Jarvis Caves, I think, which are quite popular as well. Maybe we'll get there to escape a bit of the wind if it is too, a bit too crisp. But no, very excited to come down, explore some of the great Sydney eats and, do a little bit more podcasting with you, Susie.
And we will have lots of cool photos for you of the food haunts we visit. So stay tuned for that. But we, in our news this week, there was an article that came out that really took my interest. And when we had a chat about it, I think yours too, because one of the things that we don't really talk a lot about in nutrition is our period and the menstrual cycle and the impact that has on our eating behavior and our cravings and our hormones. Really, it's a bit surprising because so much of our work is with women and we all have a monthly cycle that goes with it. So we thought, given that a significant proportion of our listeners are women, it makes perfect sense that we perhaps talk a little bit more about it. And when we take a closer look at the research around the menstrual cycle and nutrition, there's actually quite a few things that link to nutritional intake and the way we eat and the way it can impact our symptoms like cramping and cravings. And then, of course, you on your own podcast, Leanne Ward Nutrition, which is also a top rating podcast. So subscribe there if you haven't already. I also saw that recently you actually had an expert on who was talking about this area. So to kick us off, what were the key things that came up in your chat with her when it comes to the menstrual cycle and what we eat?
So this is probably a little while ago now. I think Dr. Stacey Sims was probably, I reckon, close to a year ago now, but the information is still as relevant. Now, Dr. Stacey Sims is one of the, I would say, world-leading experts in the nutrition and female physiology space. So she's really leading this research space. She's based over in New Zealand in the space of females and nutrition and their unique physiology. So she really looks at how female athletes are performing, because if you look at all of the research in sports nutrition, 99% of it, Susie, is done on males. And females have reproductive systems. We get periods. We have menstrual cycles. We have hormones. So she really is a world-leading expert in this area. So if you listeners are wanting to know more about this, I've got episodes 36 and 37 on my Leanne Ward Nutrition podcast, both with Dr. Stacey Sims. The first one is called Train Like a Girl, Optimizing Nutrition and Training Specifically for Females. And episode 37 is on tailoring your nutrition to your unique female physiology. They are two of the highest trending episodes on my podcast to date, and for very, very, very good reason. And I guess my biggest takeaways from chatting with Dr. Stacey were really, I used to think, oh, you know, we shouldn't train during our periods, or, oh, I feel awful during my period for those couple of days. I'm just going to take it easy from training. I'm just going to, you know, eat a little bit more soul food or a little bit more junk food. But knowing now what I do, it's more the worst time of the month is not actually during menses, it's in the lead up to your period. So it's during the mid to late luteal phase, which is about 5 to 7 days before your period actually starts. So most women feel worse in the week leading up to their cycle than they actually do during their cycle. And it's because progesterone and estrogen interplay and they cause a bit of metabolic havoc in our system, Susie. So in those first couple of days leading up to our period, our core temperature is raised. So we're a lot hotter, we sweat a lot more. It can make exercise a bit more difficult because we have a harder time cooling our body. And if anyone's like me, I sort of know my period's coming up because I'll wake up in the middle of the night and have to throw the blankets off or go and turn the fan or the air conditioner on because I'm like, oh, I'm just a bit hot at the moment. And that's sort of one of the first indications for me that my cycle's about to start. And also in terms of females and training, we can't access stored carbohydrate as well in the days leading up to our cycle, which makes it really hard to hit those higher intensity workouts or those big lifts. So estrogen and progesterone also have a hard time during this week leading up to our period, crossing the blood-brain barrier, which means that this increases central nervous system fatigue. So things, particularly training, feel a lot harder. So the worst time of the month for most women is actually not while you're bleeding. It's in the lead up to that. So Dr. Stacey's got quite a lot of recommendations in terms of nutrition and also trying to reduce a lot of those symptoms related to PMS. And in her book, which is called Raw, which I highly recommend any female athlete, even if you're not a you know, quote unquote athlete, even if you just really like exercise, in order to optimize your own personal exercise performance to your menstrual cycle, I'd highly recommend getting Dr. Stacey's book, Raw. And in that, she talks about having a bit of an action plan for your period. So she mentions taking, for about a week leading up to your period starting, 250 milligrams of magnesium, 45 milligrams of zinc, 80 milligrams of baby aspirin, and a gram of omega-3 fatty acids. All of that in a week leading up to your cycle. So I know a lot of our listeners, just like you and I, Susie, are more, you know, holistic health based. We want to try the food first option. So definitely just take some Panadol, some aspirin. That really helps with the pain and the inflammatory response because our period is an inflammatory response. And what we want to do in order to reduce the symptoms and the PMS is really to reduce the inflammation. So focus on foods that are rich in zinc, magnesium, and omega-3s. So Susie, I'm thinking meat, salmon, shellfish, legumes, nuts, seeds, dark chocolate, dairy, and whole grains, and also eggs are really, really good as well. So load up your diet with those sorts of foods in the week leading up to your period. And I think a lot of people will find that their PMS symptoms and the actual period cramping itself can actually become quite significantly reduced. These strategies can take about 3 cycles to really see the full effects of them, put it that way. So you might not see the full effect within, you know, that cycle. Give it a couple of months. And I really do hope that things settle down for a lot of ladies.
And I think it really also depends on how your experience of PMS is, because there's definitely people who really experience extreme symptoms and are probably listening to this and thinking, I am absolutely going to try that, because everyone is so different. I think the thing that has always stood out to me of the research around the menstrual cycle is the fact that there is an increased calorie requirement, about 300 calories, about 1,000 kilojoules extra that you require in that week or so before. So when we say that we're suddenly very, very hungry or craving things, there's actually a physiological base to that. So when you might be feeling all of a sudden like you just cannot get enough food, or you're really craving carbohydrate, or it might translate into a craving for chocolate, there is some scientific rationale for all that. And so a rationale or something I'll talk to clients about is, you know, I'm not giving you permission to go and eat a block of chocolate. What I'm saying is that that desire to eat is real. The body does need extra calories. It's definitely not a time to be overly restrictive with your diet. And if you are just trying to control calories and not have a complete blowout that makes you feel worse, you know, indulge, but buy a portion control treat. So buy yourself an individual chocolate or an individual ice cream to satisfy that craving. Or even better, you know, use some whole grain toast with peanut butter and banana. So you're getting all the nutritional benefits we've spoken about with nutrients like zinc and magnesium and whole grains in something that's still sweet. So absolutely don't be too hard on yourself when it comes to eating a little bit more in that period of time. Pardon the pun. But I think the interesting thing about that supplementary cycle that I find taking from the research is that just be mindful that sometimes that load of magnesium can make bloating a little bit worse if you're sensitive to it. So if you're someone who has that symptom and sometimes is a bit sensitive on the tummy, I would just grade that up quite gently, because I've had a few people who've added a lot of magnesium into their diet because they had felt that it's better for muscle cramps or for sleep, and then they've had like really irritable bowel symptoms of almost diarrhea and unsettled tummy. So I would just grade up and be a bit careful with magnesium supplementation. Mm-hmm. And, you know, the whole foods, like we know, the leafy greens. One, another trick with the fluid retention that we all get, and I know myself, I'll look in the mirror, I'll put my clothes on, and I'll feel like, oh God, I'm feeling like heavy. And then sure enough, my period will come like a day or two later. So I reckon it's about a 1 or 2 kilo fluid load. But a little trick nutritionally that I often use is just a really rich veggie juice, like a beetroot, celery, carrot. That incredibly high load of potassium that comes from soups and veggie juices will help to rid that fluid and just make you feel a little bit lighter, particularly if you're trying to get ready for an event and you don't want to be feeling so heavy. A veggie juice or veggie soup that few days before would help to rid that extra fluid. Whereas, of course, indulging on salty food from takeaway or foods we buy away from the home would actually make it much worse.
Yeah, and a good point with the magnesium as well. You know, and a lot of people do, and I don't generally recommend this. It's definitely not a long-term, I guess, approach for constipation, but a lot of people do take high doses of magnesium to get their bowels going. So I really do think food first, and if you are going to try the supplementary protocol that Dr. Stacey Sims recommends, absolutely touch base with your healthcare professional. I probably should have mentioned that previously, particularly if you are taking other types of medications as well, because as we know, medications and even natural herbal supplements can absolutely interact with one another as well. So please, please touch base with your healthcare professionals. And good point that you made, Susie, about the extra calorie load that most females make. I think the research has actually recently pulled it back down a little bit. It's sort of about 120 calories up to about sort of 200. I wouldn't really say for most females it's as high as 300. So just bear that in mind, depending on how tall you are, how active you are, and your body size as well. You know, it's not one size fits all. So great point about the extra calories, Susie, but I think for listeners at home, it really does depend on your own body size and shape as well.
And of course, everyone's so different, aren't they? You know, sometimes I don't realize I'm going to get my period until my husband tells me I'm acting like a complete psychopath. And then again, sure enough, 2 days later. So I think, you know, you can take that information and apply it to your own experience. And you may experience quite bad crampings when you're actually having your cycle. And so some of those tips may be particularly beneficial there, or you may really feel the fluid retention. So it's absolutely taking some of these principles to make that period of the month a little bit easier.
I like that pun. And also just trying to normalize what is normal. I actually did a wonderful episode, not to plug my own podcast again, Susie, but I'm going to. Episode 90 on the Leanne Ward Nutrition podcast was all about endometriosis. So knowing what normal actually is, if your flow is so heavy that you need to put a towel down when you sit down, or you're changing your tampon every hour, or you're anemic because of how heavy your flow is, those sorts of things aren't what we would consider normal. So absolutely do go and see your GP if you have significant amounts of pain. I mean, you can pop a Panadol, put a little heat pack on, but if you're lying in bed, you've got to call in sick to work, if you're vomiting, if you're curled up in a ball on the bathroom floor and you can't move because of the pain, that's not normal. That's not normal PMS or normal period pain for most people. So I would absolutely encourage you to go and have a chat with your healthcare professional about potentially other conditions such as endometriosis or PCOS or something like that. So we really want to normalize what normal actually is, don't we, Susie?
100%. But you're absolutely right in terms of the blood loss, because at least 25% of Australian women will have low iron stores. Now, low iron makes you feel like you've been hit by a bus. And I cannot tell you how many of my female clients, they'll describe being really fatigued. If you ask them about their periods, they will say, yes, they have quite heavy periods. And sure enough, you know, their iron's so low, they're often needing a whole infusion. Mm-hmm. So pay attention to that, because it can be a real indicator that you need to have your iron levels checked. That extreme fatigue where you wake up in the morning, feel like you haven't slept, and yet you're still bleeding heavily each month is a sign I would definitely be getting your iron checked.
Absolutely. So if anything doesn't feel normal or is debilitating or is making you call in sick for work regularly, or if you're chatting to your girlfriends and you're, you know, completely different to some of the symptoms they're feeling, it's probably just best for you to go and touch base with your doctor as well, just to get everything checked out and make sure that your normal is actually normal as well.
100%.
So I hope, listeners, that these tips make your monthly cycle a little bit easier to deal with. Being females, it's, you know, Susie and I can relate. It's hard some months, isn't it, Susie? But I guess talking about the PMS and the period cravings brings us to a little clinic case study of the week, which is all about treats. I mean, we talk about treats a lot. I personally call them soul foods, Susie. We can call them treats. We can call them junk foods. We can call them overly processed foods, whatever you want to call them. The question is, how many is too many? Like, what is a treat? How do we define a treat? And how often should we be indulging or eating these treats?
You hear it so often because people are constantly looking for a reason to reward themselves. You know, let's be honest, life is hard. The days are long and we get to the end of the day and we feel like we just deserve something to get us through. And inevitably that's, you know, as you said, described as junk food or discretionary foods, which are basically foods that are not giving us a lot of key nutrients to be considered core foods, but a lot of pleasure. So it might be your chocolate or your ice cream or your baked goods or your biscuits or your wine even. But I hear it talked all the time with kids, because I think there's a whole generation of parents, myself included, and we use treats to guide behavior. We're lucky in this generation where we have the means and opportunities to be constantly giving our kids lovely things. So you go to the coffee shop and then you give the kids a treat of banana bread. And then that's not once a week though, which was the case when I grew up, and you might have takeaway once a week and a very occasional block of Cadbury's. Now it's daily. Absolutely, it's a daily thing that kids are often having treats, and sometimes multiple times through the day, because they might have a treat at school and then there might be someone's birthday, so someone's brought cupcakes for them, and then their mum's put a treat in the lunchbox because you want to be, you know, a great mum. And then, of course, at the end of the day, they're expecting a treat because they think that they have dessert. So I think that it's good for us to bring out into the open a bit of a discussion around it. So let's go from the science first. If we model a diet and put in all the key foods you need on a daily basis to tick your nutrient boxes, we say you're consuming a calorie load, 1,500 calories. In my experience, there's usually a couple of hundred calories left to play with if you're doing your activity. So the way I work with my own clients is I sort of factor in about 100, maybe 150 calories of something each day that people can factor in. So if they love nothing more than a glass of wine, great. If they want a couple of squares, a row of chocolate, you know, a portion control ice cream, I can fit that into their nutritional profile. But the biggest issue I see, Leanne, and the reason this doesn't work, is that my definition of what a portion treat is very different to how it's often perceived. So mm-hmm. A portion of chocolate is 20 grams. Now that is a Freddo. It's mm-hmm. not a row even of chocolate, it's a Freddo. What happens is people blow their treats out, and what is 100 ml of wine very quickly becomes 250. So over time, we get used to having more and more, and then all of a sudden we're having extras of 200, 300, 400 calories every day. And that's where we go wrong.
Absolutely. And even as you're mentioning the kids treats, I had a coffee with a good girlfriend the other day, and she brought her little one who's about a toddler, and we ordered coffees and the toddler got a baby chino. And the baby chino came and it was, you know, tiny as it is, with a little shake of the chocolate powder on top, and it came with two marshmallows. And I just remember thinking, even that, like, it just used to be a baby chino. But now I've been out to coffee shops with friends and the baby chino comes with one or two chocolate freckles, or it comes with a couple of marshmallows. Even that is a treat in itself, which I think a lot of parents don't realize. And then they go and order the kid a treat as well. So it's a bit of banana bread or a muffin or, you know, something else on top of that. So they've actually had two treats in the one sitting, forgetting that, you know, a lot of times baby chinos come with their own little treats as well. It's no longer just a baby chino these days, is it? So it's all of those little things add up.
And we all think that when we have our own kids, we're not going to give them the marshmallow or the freckle. Let me tell you, you keep the lollies in the car to keep them on track, those kids. So it's easier in theory, let me tell you. But you're absolutely right. The biggest issue I see with kids' treats is the size. In the coffee shops generally, they're not kid-style portions. Sometimes they are. Sometimes you see like a mini cupcake. But you're right. Often the mini cupcake's got lollies on top as well. Or they have a big sort of smarty cookie, or they have a whole piece of banana bread. So, you know, a two-year-old treat is, like you said, one freckle. It's not, you know, multiple things. So I think as parents, just becoming aware of how often these little extras are slipping in. And that's where there's good opportunity to create that healthier kind of treat, whether it's making your own frozen yogurt on a stick that you can throw some berries and maybe a few choc chips in, or making a healthier banana bread at home that you can incorporate some extra veggies into. But the portions for little kids need to be really small. So when, for example, I'm packing lunches for my kids who are five, I never put a whole packet of biscuits or crackers into their lunchbox. I put a few out of the packet because they're five. Mm-hmm. They don't need the whole packet. Like, that's perhaps for a 10-year-old child. So I think just constantly coming back to smaller portions. Or another trick for adults may be to limit the number of days you have it. So rather than, say, try and limit yourself to 100 ml of wine each night, maybe you're better to go 3 or 4 days with not much. So when it comes to the weekend where we all are going to have way too many treats, then you've sort of buffered yourself from a calorie perspective, because portion is generally where it goes wrong.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And there is sort of a concept known as, what is it, calorie cycling or carb cycling, even sort of within the fitness space, where you can cycle your calories low some days during the week and then higher on the weekend, so that you're averaging out whatever calorie load that is, whether it makes you at a deficit or at maintenance at the end of the week, pulling yourself down during the week and then increasing on the weekend to have a bit more of a buffer, as you mentioned, for our extra snacks and our soul foods. But that also, when we're talking about the kids, I know we're jumping between kids and adults here, but I have a lot of friends who will homemade treats for their kids, which I think is wonderful. You know what goes into it, but a homemade muffin in the size of a muffin that you're going to give a 3, 4, 5-year-old is still too large a portions, because homemade treats are still, you know, they might have mashed bananas in there instead of sugar. They still have natural amounts of sugar in there. Even if you're using, half the amount of sugar or something like that, it's still quite a lot of, I would still call it a treat. I would still call a homemade treat a treat, put it that way. And growing up, I was very fortunate to have a mum who was very, very interested in nutrition and health, and we were lucky if we got a homemade treat once a week. We would never, ever get something like a bought muffin from a cafe ever. But even if we got a homemade treat, it was once or twice a week. She'd make up 12 muffins and she'd freeze the rest. So the 12 muffins that she made between me, my sister and my brother would last us, you know, close to a month or something like that. So we were lucky if we got, a homemade muffin or a homemade piece of banana bread or something in our lunchbox once or twice a week. So I think even the frequency of the homemade treats that a lot of parents are putting in their kids' lunchboxes, the size of them and the frequency probably needs to be reduced as well, because the rise of childhood obesity and overweight in kids, and even the amount of children being diagnosed with type 2 diabetes it's heartbreaking to see these days, particularly in Australia and America.
Because we program to eat more, really from a very young age, because we force them to eat the foods we want and then we reward them with extra treats. But the good thing is you can buy like mini muffin tins. You can buy the mini loaf tins rather than making the whole banana bread. You can buy kid size portions. It's really important that they stick to that. But I think that you're absolutely right. When it comes to heavier items like dessert, like ice cream, like cake, once or twice a week is what you would be looking at for overall nutritional balance, but also to teach children that's how often we kind of indulge and get a balance between healthy eating and then more treat type foods. And that's a really important message for kids, it's easier said than done when you're parenting, because you're trying to constantly shift behavior, but having a few little knickknacks and toys as things to be giving to them rather than food, because as parents, you're always wanting to give them stuff is a sign of love, which isn't at all what it should be. But at least if you've got little toys or cards or something else, it takes the focus off food. And that's really quite important.
Absolutely. Because what we learn as kids, we grow up with, and a lot of adults really struggle with that self-reward. They reward themselves with food after a hard day, after a long day, after a sad day, after a happy day. We use food as a reward. And a lot of that comes back to our childhood, where we were rewarded as children for doing well in school, for getting first in the running race, for falling over and skidding on our knees. Our parents are like, well, you're sad, let's go get some ice cream. We really do pick up on a lot of these habits right back to our childhood and carry them through to adulthood, which is where a lot of us are running into problems with a lot of the deep-rooted issues in terms of emotional eating and that sort of thing.
100%. And I think the other thing is, if you don't want to eat it, don't keep it in the house, because most of us will eat what's around. So if you buy the chocolate each week and then are expecting yourself not to eat it, like, you're kidding yourself. So you've got to keep it out of the house and actually make the focus when you are having it going to get it. Or if you are someone who likes something sweet or something special at the end of each day, you've got to go for calorie control. So I'd say, as a rough guide, work off 100 calories. And there is quite a few, we've spoken about the hot chocolate drinks before. There's quite a few little of the sweet unsweetened yogurts now that have sort of got some sweetener through them to give you that sweet hit. a number of little ice blocks and frozen yogurts on a stick that come in, you know, 50, 60 calories. So mm-hmm. if you're checking labels and you do want to include something regularly, sticking to that 100 calorie or less daily will help to keep your calories under control.
Absolutely. And I guess to bring us back to the original question that we had, how many is too many? So you mentioned for kids, I think a couple of times a week, bearing in mind, you know, the things that you put in their lunchboxes can also be treats. If you go to a cafe once or twice a week, that's a treat. If grandma's known to give the kids treats, picking them up from school once or twice a week, they're all treats as well. So really trying to reduce the load for our kids and for adults. I mean, I would probably say 3-4 times a week, as long as it's, as you mentioned, in that calorie perspective, knowing that also adults will go out for a meal that I would consider a treat if we're going and having a palmy at a pub, or if we're going and we're having some pizza and a vino with some friends, I would consider that pizza something that I would call a treat as well. Are you on the same page as me, Susie? I'm thinking 3-4 times a week for most adults.
I think it's saying the same thing, but I say 2 meals off, mm-hmm. which would fall into that. And so for anything significant that's bigger a couple of times, and then there's maybe room for a couple of small desserts or a glass or two of wine. So for everyone, it's knowing what your personal lifestyle is like and how often you do that, and whether you're someone who does have something small every day or whether you eat out 2 or 3 times a week, and straight away we know that's going to be a complete calorie blowout, and that means the other days you are going to keep it pretty controlled. And I think nutritionally, probably the shift with calorie loads, like we've spoken about, where it's not always the same, has been a big shift in my own practice. Acknowledging that people will go and have big weekends or nights where they're out with their girls and have 4 glasses of wine. So how do you buffer that? And that's a really powerful strategy, so you can differentiate the treats and they don't just slip in on a daily basis and they're kind of mindless then. You don't even realize you're having them. So I think, yeah, stating it as a definite, this is my meal off or this is my treat for the week, I think helps you to keep a tab on it as well, so the mindless stuff doesn't just slip in.
Couldn't agree more.
All right. Now, we're excited about this next segment because product of the week, we always get a lot of feedback about this. Everyone loves to talk supermarket products. And I have been a fan of this yogurt for a long time, as have you, once we've discussed it. But the other exciting news is it's starting to become available in mainstream supermarkets. So the product we're talking about today is the Evia Greek Natural Strained Yogurt, which is available in a range of different varieties. There's the full cream variety. There's also now a skim variety. Now, there's also flavoured ones. There's a whole range. And they were available for a long time in, I think it's Sydney, Melbourne. I don't think they've got a Harris Farm in Queensland yet, but I believe one's coming. I just read last week, sort of a specialty grocer called Harris Farm. And so my clients would sometimes bring it to me and I would say, yeah, it's a great product, but you couldn't necessarily get it. But it's been available recently in Woolworths. And so when I mentioned it to you, you said, I love that yogurt. So we thought it was very much worthy of a discussion. And in summary, one of the reasons I like it is that it's really high in protein. It doesn't have any added sugars or additives. It's a great source of probiotics. There is a full cream variety as well as a skim. So you do have to be a little bit careful because the full cream variety does have cream added to it. So it's quite high in fat. But most importantly, and something that happens with yogurts, is sometimes the high protein yogurts, even though nutritionally they look good, it's hard to get them tasting great. And the thing that I love about this yogurt and the feedback I get from clients is that they love the taste of it as well. So it's also ticking the box on that important aspect of eating, which is that it tastes good. So yeah, the Evia Greek Natural Strain Yogurt, and I think the skim one is probably our personal preference from a nutritional perspective. But when I said it to you, you were really familiar with it. So tell me about your love of Evia.
Yeah, I found this in one of my friends, Greta. She's a dietitian. She introduced me to this years ago when we used to work at the hospital together, and we both used to have it for morning tea most days, and it was available in my Woolworths years ago. And for some reason, I've moved house, as you know, and we're over in Tennyson at the moment, and there's a big new Woolworths near me and it doesn't stock it, Susie, and I'm heartbroken. So as you mentioned, it's coming into a lot of the Woolworths, but for some reason it's gone out of my new Woolworths, so I'm a bit sad about that. But I did find it years ago, and I was actually using the full cream variety years ago because, as you mentioned, they do add cream to it, and that was just my treat. So I talk very much with my clients about mouth hunger, where it's not something that I want a lot of. I'm not eating because I'm hungry. I just want the pure taste or pleasure or satisfaction of something. And I think it's because of the added cream. I would have 2 teaspoons of this, maybe after a meal, or maybe if I just felt like something a little bit decadent or creaming or delicious. And that just hit the spot every time. So one 700 gram tub would last me a week. easily. Like I wasn't eating it as I would normal yogurt, where I'd eat 150, 200 grams. I was literally using the full cream variety as a really good treat. And then I think the low fat variety is a great option for if you're conscious about your weight or if you're wanting to, I guess, control that calorie load. It's great to put with a bit of fresh fruit or even a little bit of muesli in the morning. So I think that the low fat variety is probably better nutritionally, but if you're somebody who really does value the taste and texture, the full cream variety is absolutely delicious. They add natural probiotic cultures into it as well. And it's made from 99% Australian ingredients, which for me, that's a big thing. I really do look for more of those Aussie made products or using Australian based ingredients. And as we mentioned, the ingredient list in the full cream variety is just fresh pasteurized milk and cream, skim milk powder, and live probiotic cultures. Three ingredients, Susie. So it's very quote unquote clean. There's not a lot of additives or additional things in there, which is great to see. And, you know, as we mentioned, it does taste delicious.
And I'm just looking at the nutritionals of the full cream variety. So like you said, on 100 grams, which is about a sort of small half cup, like you said, a few tablespoons because it's quite rich, you're still getting 10 grams of protein. You're getting 7 grams of total fat. Over four is saturated because, of course, it's dairy. You're only getting 2.3 grams of natural sugar. So like you said, if you consume it in a controlled portion and get that mouthfeel from it and it's very satisfying, it's nutritionally a million times better than processed ice cream or chocolate, especially if you enjoyed it with some fresh berries, some pepitas, some nuts, you know, or made it into your own ice cream and froze it. Then if your desire is to keep calories controlled and have less fat, the skim one is going to still give you that fantastic protein load in a really clean product. And I just think it's great. I've always heard amazing things. I'm just having a look about the background of the company. It says there's fifth generation artisans and it's Sydney made. So that's the other thing. It's an Australian product. And if we have a look at the yogurts in the supermarket, there's not that many that are Australian. And of the ones that are, there's not that many, which we would probably give the tick of approval nutritionally when it comes to the macronutrients or the protein, carbohydrates, sugar loads. So I'm a big, big fan. And I think there's potentially roles for the full cream and the skim. And of course, another common nutrition question is, do we have full cream dairy or skim? You know, if anyone under the age of 5 should be having full cream dairy. So if you were giving it to the kids, mind you, I think it's quite high in protein for small kids. I'd probably wait till they're in primary school or older to be giving them this higher protein yogurt or using it as an ice cream alternative and freezing it into ice cream blocks. But for most of my clients, I'd probably say go with the skim just to help reduce intake of saturated fat. And yogurt eaters tend to be pretty used to having a reduced fat yogurt. So it's a really strong product. It's really great. It's in Woolies. I think keep an eye on the nutritionals, but absolutely, this is the strongest yogurt I've seen for quite some time nutritionally. And importantly, it's a Greek yogurt, not Greek style yogurt, because there's a big difference. Mm-hmm. If it says Greek style, it tends to be processed in a way they use a lot more thickeners and mixers. It doesn't have the nutritional density that a full Greek yogurt does. So definitely check that, because there's a lot of Greek style yogurts out there and they don't have the benefits of full Greek yogurt.
And two more points, Susie. I wouldn't consider this a lactose-free or low-lactose product. So people who struggle to digest dairy might struggle with this brand. But the thicker the yogurt, the lower the lactose content naturally. So again, if you're having just a smaller calorie-controlled amount of this or a portion-controlled amount of this, say a tablespoon or two, with a little bit of fresh fruit and a bit of muesli or something, you might actually be able to tolerate that quite well, even with a lactose intolerance. And I think it's safe for celiacs as well. I'm just looking at the ingredient list and it doesn't mention, obviously there's no gluten added, but it doesn't mention the processing in the factories of any cross-contamination or anything like that. So I think it's safe for our celiacs out there as well, which is great. And the skim variety has a 5-star health rating as well. So as we mentioned, one of the better yogurts on the market at the moment, which is great to see.
It is. So well done, Woolworths, because it's really helpful when our major supermarkets stock some of these great products. So hopefully we'll see a few more from the range coming through. And if you haven't tried it already, give it a go and let us know what you think.
And to bring us to the end of our podcast, Susie, we're going to do a quick listener question that came in via our Instagram account. So our Instagram is the Nutrition Couch Podcast on Instagram and on Facebook as well. Send us your listener questions. You can either send us a DM or you can just add a comment to one of our posts there. And the one that came up today, Susie, is one that comes up quite a lot. It's an age-old question. We've been asking it for how many years now? Butter or margarine? Susie, where do you sit on the side of the fence? Are you a butter girl? Are you a margarine girl?
I have both at home, full disclosure. I generally always use butter for baking. I've been experimenting a bit more with some extra virgin olive oil in recipes, and we'll get to that in another episode. But my preference for baking is to always go back to butter. I tend to always use less than what is written on the recipe just to keep, again, intake of fat low. Margarine. Goodness gracious me, there's so many. And even the buttery margarines are very rarely much butter, most of them. I think there's only one. I think the mainland is a butter spread. Most of them are blended vegetable oils, which nutritionally, generally speaking, nutritional professionals are not fans of because they're highly processed. They're not offering much nutrients. And really, when you look at a diet, we don't need it. So the only time I use it is when my kids have toast in the morning. I will use a light variety with a reasonably high mix of good quality oil for Vegemite toast. Any other time, I don't use it. So I think the less margarine you have in your diet, the better. The only reason I don't buy spreadable butter is I think I did a margarine story on TV a while ago and I had like 8 tubs of it. So I'm just kind of slowly using it up, but I use it like once a day. I don't use it except for Vegemite toast and I've got one child who likes that. So I think that the less of it you use in the diet, the better. For spreads in general, we're not getting any real positive nutrition from them. I think nutritionally butter is better. You've got to make sure though, if you're getting a butter spread, it's 100% butter. But as I said, I don't actively add them to the diet. It would be very sporadically I use it. And I definitely don't advise clients to be buying things like the cholesterol lowering margarines because I would never encourage someone to put a processed food back in the diet to reduce cholesterol. So the take home message is the less of any spread you use, the better. And nutritionally, probably you'd argue butter as it's natural, but keep it thin regardless. It's not adding anything positive to your diet.
Absolutely. And I've always sort of been of the opinion growing up, my mum used to always use the olive oil spread. So that's sort of very familiar to me. We never really used a lot of butter. I don't really eat a lot of toast or bread. I rarely ever bake. If I want a treat, I'll probably go out and buy something. If I make 12 muffins, I'm going to eat 12 muffins. So I rarely bake. I don't have kids at the moment. So for me, it's something that, you know, I might use a bit of butter or margarine or olive oil spread. I don't know, maybe once or twice a month or something like that. Like it's such a rare occasion. And in baking, I 90% of the time will always use extra virgin olive oil instead of butter or marge. So I most of the times don't even have it in my fridge. And I think it really does come down to the amount that you're using. You know, I think I know a lot of people who will add, you know, butter into their vegetables, you know, cook some steams and broccoli and add some butter on top or, you know, have toast every morning for breakfast. So I think if you are using quite a lot of it, I do agree with you. I think margarines can be overly processed. So I think a lower salt proper butter is probably a better option, but it really does come down to the amount. If you're someone that uses it so infrequently like myself, use butter, use margarine, it doesn't really matter at the end of the day, does it? You're just using a small amount.
And on toast in general, you're going to be better with avocado, you're going to be better with 100% nut spread, and there's so many of them. So most people I would see, I'm not prescribing plain toast anyway. I want it to be a protein toast with nut spread and banana, or I want it to be an egg on toast, and then you don't need it at all. And that's why I don't use it, because if I am having toast, I'll have Vegemite without, I don't need it when I'm going to have my egg. It's giving me the moisture there. So I think the message from us, the dietitians today, is the less spreads really you have in your diet, the better, because we need to get our fats from good sources, things like our extra virgin olive oil, our nut spreads, our avocado. That's where we're getting positive nutritional intake from, and that's where we're getting the fats that we actually need. And, you know, with mashed potato or mashed veggies, I use the olive oil and the salt. I don't, again, use the butter in that. So, you know, I think we're programmed to keep those added fats as minimal as possible in the diet.
And just to touch on the point you made about the cholesterol lowering spreads, I do get asked that quite a lot from just friends and family, and clients will DM me on Instagram. And I am of the same opinion as you. I rarely, rarely ever recommend them, because what a lot of people don't understand is that it's a dose response relationship. So to get the effects of the cholesterol lowering, I believe from the top of my head, I think it's 2 grams of plant sterols a day, which actively means that you can't just use half a teaspoon of a little bit of butter on your toast. You actually have to use the 2 grams of that margarine a day, which I think is like probably close to 2 tablespoons every single day, Susie, to get the clinical benefits of the cholesterol lowering of the plant sterols. That's a lot of calories extra that you're adding into your diet, probably 200-300 extra calories. So if you're not someone who regularly uses 1 to 2 tablespoons of margarine or butter a day, there's no real point in using the cholesterol lowering margarines, because you're not going to get any clinical benefit unless you can use the amount that's needed to actively reduce the cholesterol. And as I said, from memory, I think it's 2 grams, but don't quote me on that.
I think it's 2 to 3 grams of plant sterols. I think that's right. But there's also a milk now. The Heartwise milk also contains the plant sterols. So if I wanted that effect with someone who was quite lean but still looking for a reduction in cholesterol, I would absolutely start them on the milk, and of course more dietary fiber and soluble fiber. I never use that margarine, so I couldn't agree more. All right. Well, that brings us to the end of another episode of the Nutrition Couch. If you haven't done so already, please subscribe to have us delivered to your inbox every Sunday morning. And we would love it if you could leave us a review. We've had quite a few and we're really grateful. So thank you for that. We have our Instagram and Facebook pages running for any feedback, questions, and you'll see all of our product posts that we talk about here on the podcast. It's the Nutrition Couch podcast. And we look forward to seeing you the same time, same place next Sunday. Have a great week.
Catch you guys next week.